Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. In 2011, author Greg Iles suffered life-threatening injuries in an automobile accident that took his right leg and made him question his return to writing. It ultimately became his path to recovery. He poured himself into an epic trilogy that begins with the new Natchez Burning. At nearly 800 pages, Natchez Burning takes us from the present day, with its protagonist Penn Cage, the mayor of his hometown, to a series of brutal civil rights murders from the 1960s. It is a great pleasure to welcome Greg Iles to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. I appreciate it.
It's great to be here, Joe. Thanks.
This book has been in before your accident, and it has been in the works for a long time, but this became a much different book, didn't it?
Yes, it did, Joe. At the time of my accident, it was conceived as a one-volume entry into the Penn Cage series, which, of course, I'd never meant to be a series to start with. But my dad died about 5 years before the accident, and I'd already begun to question whether the book did the subject justice, because I was writing about my family, the South, race, civil rights. And when I pulled onto Highway 61 and a truck hit my driver's door going 70 miles an hour, ripped my aorta, broke 20-something bones, took my leg off, and I was in a coma for 8 days, a lot like my bandmate Stephen King, you know, and when he was run over by the van. It's a transformative experience. And when I came out of that, I had a completely different take on the novel. I simply thought, I'm not going to pull a single punch. I'm going to write this book as it needs to be written. And it very swiftly grew into three very large volumes, which are outside the publishing formula box.
Talk a little bit about outside that publishing formula box, because these aren't just regular entries into a series about Penn Cage. This is a very deliberate trilogy. The books are large, 800 pages, dense, and very serious in places of dealing with deadly serious issues.
Well, when you look at modern publishing, all readers know that in the commercial side, the business is geared to one book a year, particularly from best-selling authors. And I was on that hamster wheel to a degree. And frequently you see authors essentially rewriting their last book each year. I'm nothing against that, you know. I'm a big fan of some series. I was always against series myself because I tried in a single volume to deal with the watershed moments of a character's life and the issue and then move on. But this book is unique in many ways, the primary one being that the three volumes do not stand alone. Now, we've become accustomed to that with things like The Hunger Games, but that was a YA novel. And the Dragon Tattoo series is frequently pointed to, but that was originally conceived as a 10-volume series. It's that Stieg Larsson simply died after the third volume. So you can imagine for a publisher to look at three huge volumes, two and a half times the length of a normal book, and each book not standing alone. From a commercial point of view, that would be very risky. And the truth is, before this book has come out, I wound up with a different publisher and a different agent. We'll leave that in the shadows there, but right. It has all worked out for the best. It sounds like a cliche, but I'll say this. When we heard the other night that this book is going to debut at number 2 on the New York Times bestseller list, there was celebration for a lot of reasons, because everyone along the chain had put their faith into something that by any conventional wisdom standard would not have succeeded.
The thing that so impressed me about the book is that you have so much to say, and the feeling at the end of 800 pages, and yes, I think this is rare, when you come to the end of an 800-page novel and you say, oh, I wish I had another 800 pages to find out what's going on. Was there ever a doubt in your mind, or was there ever a thought that would be difficult to sustain?
I'll tell you what was hard, Joe. It wasn't sustaining the high pitch, because when you're writing about the things I'm writing about, the Ku Klux Klan and thinly veiled, frankly, civil rights murders from the 1960s that actually took place, it's not difficult to sustain suspense or to take readers on a ride. Here was the challenge. The challenge was to actually break what is essentially one story into three volumes and not have the reader slam volume 1 shut in fury and say, I'll never pick up another Iles book again. because you're withholding the central knot of the mystery that propels the novel. And that scared me to death as I approached the end. And it finally struck me that the solution to that dilemma was to leave the reader so emotionally wrung out that he or she would say, "Whew, okay, I need a break before I pick up the second volume."
And that's one of the things that struck me, is that for you as the writer, it must have been emotional. And at a time when, obviously in your life, it's a very emotional time.
Joe, I'll say this. I tend to be a very frank guy, very informal in my talks. Almost all writers write about themselves. If they tell you they don't, they're lying. And there's a simple reason. You can't move people by making stuff up. If you can, you're a magician, not a storyteller. Each writer, each musician, each artist has a finite amount of suffering, joy, all the emotions we've all lived through since childhood, and that is the raw material of your craft. And what I've learned is that as an artist, you dole out small pieces of that. And when I do, when I have, it's always that piece of a book, that paragraph where the emails start to come in from Iceland or Japan or Brazil or China. It doesn't even matter where the reader lives. They all say the same thing. You know, I cried at the bottom of page 274. And inevitably, it will be one of those painful parts of my own life that I was willing to put out into that book. And in Natchez Burning, I probably put more of those moments than in any other novel.
You talk about writing about yourself, but there's the conscious effort in, there's the conscious decision in writing about your hometown, where you live, that place. So there are so many connections that it makes it much more personal, doesn't it?
It does. And, you know, I'm frequently asked, how can you live in a town when you write about it the way you do? And the funny thing is, you know, fame is a double-edged sword. This man's dead now, so I can say it. My first Penn Cage novel was called The Quiet Game, and it was loosely based upon a race murder, and the antagonist in that book was named Judge Leo Marston. I actually had a Mississippi Supreme Court justice going around the state bragging that he was the basis of Leo Marston. So you never know what the reaction will be. Now, my feeling now when people ask about Natchez Burning is, you know, I haven't gotten back from the tour. I'm not sure my house is still standing, but I'll be able to report back. So.
We are talking to Greg Iles. The name of the new novel is Natchez Burning. When it comes to the very raw and emotional scenes of the South, a lot of this goes hand in hand with the relationship with your father, ultimately the death of your father, that led to this path in some way.
Yeah, I think of my father. I call him, you know, Atticus Finch with a stethoscope in the book. And in a lot of ways, he was like that. But I think all of us as children, we tend to worship our parents first. We find other mentors. But inevitably, at some point in our lives, whether we're 14 or 40, we become disillusioned and we realize that they're just as fallible, or perhaps even more so than we are. That's a shattering moment. And I think that's a way into this story for everyone. You know, the head of the Southeastern Booksellers Association said about this book, it was the most insightful thing I think I've heard yet, which is, she said, imagine Jim Finch grew up to learn things about Atticus that no son should ever know about his father. Mm. And that's a good analysis of the foreground story of Natchez Burning. Now, the background story, the civil rights murders that were so brutal, those are based upon actual cold cases investigated by a friend of mine who works at a tiny little newspaper in Concordia Parish, Louisiana. You know, I'd never use the Ku Klux Klan as antagonists in my novels because, A, it's too easy. B, it's not realistic. Because by the mid to late 60s, the FBI had completely infiltrated the Ku Klux Klan with informants by paying them bribes. So as one of my characters says, the Klan we got now is about as dangerous as the Garden Club. Stanley Nelson, my friend, uncovered a group called the Silver Dollar Group that wore no robes, had no meetings. All they did was carry a silver dollar minted in the year of their birth, and all they did was kill people. And not one went to prison until 40 years after the fact, and then only one. So with that, I knew I really had the canvas I needed for the background of my 1960s novel.
You were born in 1960, and you recall seeing these spots and seeing Klan members in your town.
My father, who was a physician and whose medical practice was probably 60% African-American, yet the other half, he also treated most of the workers at the manufacturing plants where the KKK members were employed. When I was about 5.5 years old, the largest Ku Klux Klan meeting ever held in the United States was held less than 1 mile from my house. And my father walked me down the road with a camera. He wanted to take pictures. And what I remember to this day, almost 50 years later, is not only the men, women, and children in the white robes, but the horses wearing the white sheets. They almost look like horses from the Crusades that you see in the movies. It was really a terrifying thing. And from that age, my father, who had served in Germany after the war and knew a lot about the Holocaust, I was lucky to be Southern, and yet I had a father and mother who taught me early on about intolerance and what the real danger and meaning of these events were.
In writing about these events and this time, you go back and forth and you weave this current story in, which ultimately brings us up to date of what is happening in Penn Cage's life. Having been a fan of your previous novels, it's very different, isn't it? It's a very different style, and it has so much more power to it.
In a way, it goes back to some of my earlier novels, particularly Black Cross, which was set in Germany largely during 1944. I mean, when you write so closely to real historical events, the writing can take on its own power, I think, independent of your own ability, simply because of the subject. Now, it's incumbent upon you as a writer to do that subject justice, I think. For me, you know, it's hard to really talk about this book. I can't classify it with any of my others. You know, I guess if they say writers have a magnum opus, you know, I don't want to sound pretentious, but this is it for me. You know, and two great moments I had with this book, Joe. One was the Washington Post reviewed it, and a friend of mine texted me and said, "Look at the review right now. You've been waiting 20 years for this review." And the last paragraph said, "Natchez Burning obliterates the line between literary and commercial fiction." And I'm not tooting my own horn, but I've waited a long time for that kind of review. You know, when Amazon.com picked their best books of the month for this month, they picked it as number one in a category. That's fine. I was hoping for that. But the meaningful thing for me was the category it was selected in was literature and fiction, not mystery and thriller. So hopefully this book and this story, which is so different and so brutally honest, will find the audience that not only it deserves to find, I think, but the people who need to read it, I think.
You write in the novel, "This was America," which meant Snake was talking about a civil war. As soon as this thought flashed through Sonny's mind, everything came clear and a feeling of peace spread through him. Appomattox hadn't ended anything. It had merely heralded an intermission. The war itself was still raging across the country, right under the shiny plastic surface of the American dream. Some people pretended not to notice or made out like the Russians were the real enemy. But anybody who'd read any history knew that great civilizations always crumbled from within, and to prevent that eventuality, Sonny was willing to kill whoever Frank said needed to die. That is not a line you typically read in commercial fiction.
No, that I hear a little echoes of James Ellroy there, possibly. But that gets at something very important. I wanted to explore the motivation of the men who committed these kind of acts. And, you know, we tend to picture those men, and rightfully so, as being from the lower middle class or the lower class white segment of society at the time. But it should never be forgotten that those men would never have gone so far as to have committed the acts of violence they did had they not had the tacit permission of the upper middle class or even the wealthy class in the form of the White Citizens Council or the Sovereignty Commission. And that's one thing I explore. You know, Martin Luther King said something very important, which was that years hence from all these events, it would not be, you know, the heinous acts committed by these evil men that were remembered, but the appalling silence of the good people. And that is what I want to explore through Tom Cage. You know, a guy like my father, who who did things for his African-American patients you wouldn't, I mean, you would believe, but things you would hope any man would do, trying to do the right thing. Yet all his life, he told me he should have done more and he wished he'd done more. You know, he knew what should have been done. And I think so many Southerners and Northerners as well knew there was more they could do, and yet they didn't, out of fear. And it's too bad.
What are the questions? Were there times through this book of, I would think constantly, that there were questions that you wanted to ask your father?
Yes. You know, I was able to discuss it with him prior to his death, and I had his blessing to go forward with it, as difficult as it was. I mean, this book explores, you know, interracial relationships, of which all you have to do is drive through the South to see there were many. There were many things I would have liked to ask him about his personal experiences. I'm not sure he would have answered everything. But one thing I would like to get across while we're in this format is, look, I'm a Southerner to my bones. You know, my ancestors fought in the cavalry for the South during the Civil War. My mother grew up on a subsistence farm, picked cotton until she was out of college, literally. You know, I dug ditches, with African-American guys. I graduated from Ole Miss. I'm as Southern as you can get. And when I'm in my home state, I'm as critical as any Mississippian who ever was. Mm. But when I'm outside the South, I defend it. And for the simple reason that the South had no monopoly on racism. Let me just, one quick story. When the Neshoba County victims died, Swerner, Cheney, and Goodman in 1964, one of the largest manhunts in history occurred. That's when the FBI office in Mississippi was opened. During that time, the bodies of two 19-year-old black men were discovered in the offshoot of the Mississippi River. There were a few hours of hysteria while they thought the civil rights workers may have been found. But as soon as it was determined that these were just two 19-year-old black boys, the spotlight moved away, and those crimes were not solved for 40 years. The lesson is, two of the three Neshoba County workers were white. And North and South, that was who the spotlight was on, that was who people cared about. When they found out just two more black boys had been killed in Mississippi, it was sort of a shrug and back to normal business. And I think that says something about the universality of prejudice and apathy about race in America as well as the world.
You write in the book that Sonny had hated both men, yet those killings had left him feeling strangely hollow, as that God had thrown away whatever rule book came with the universe, leaving humanity to sink or swim on its own. That's universal.
Yeah, and there I'm referring, as you know, to two of the assassinations of the 1960s. And I've stayed away from talking about that in interviews because there's so much interest and even hysteria still surrounding the major assassinations of the 60s. But I think we all feel that something was certainly lost. It's debated by historians, you know, the road not taken, what might have happened had Bobby Kennedy not died, had John Kennedy not died, had King not died. And so I will say this, before we end Volume 3, we will find ourselves in Dallas and Memphis, but it will not be treated in a hysterical or a sort of Oliver Stone military-industrial complex coup in America way. It'll be treated in a very realistic way, having to do primarily with the South and the city of New Orleans.
When you came to the decision to go ahead and to write this in such a complete way, what impact do you think the accident had on that?
You know, most of us go through our lives believing we're immortal. It's sort of a necessity when facing the existential void, without sounding too pretentious. I mean, most of American life is geared toward the denial of death. You know, we all know that, and we worship youth. But when fate reaches down and rips your aorta for you, and you wake up out of a coma, missing part of your body, you really can no longer deny the fact of your mortality. And once you really get that into your bones, that you have a finite amount of time to write whatever it is you're going to write, or if you're a musician, the songs you're going to play. You know, I've heard Sting express this sentiment. We all start to realize that you have a limited number of Christmases left, you have a limited number of books left, and whatever you got to say, you better say it. Again, I'll go back to Stephen King, who through Morgan Freeman as Red in Shawshank Redemption said, get busy living or get busy dying. It sounds simplistic, but it's true. I mean, I'll ask you a question. Remember when you were about 42 years old, you went to work every day, you did the same thing, you blinked your eyes, looked up, and you were 52 years old. That's what something like the accident does. It makes you say, life is so short that I know if I don't treat this subject with the frankness, the gravitas, whether it shocks people, whether it makes people mad, I don't want to die without regret on my conscience. And the great thing is that this has been allowed to happen in the sort of sphere of commercial books. That's a good thing. You know, sometimes I get depressed about where the market's going, where publishing is going, but then every now and then something happens and, you know, restores your faith.
Did you worry about being away from the game for so long?
I did to a degree. I think publishers and agents and people have to worry about that more. I always had a sense because, thankfully, with the internet, and I keep myself honestly wide open to my readers. You know, I've been advised at times to take my email address down, and you know, there are reasons for doing that. You get some pretty strange emails, angry emails from people, but I would never close that door myself because, as a musician, which I was before I was a writer, you're interacting with your fans all the time, and you're getting feedback instantaneously. It's a wonderful thing. When you're a writer, you just sit in a room by yourself for a year, 2 years, in this case, 5 years. And so that contact with those readers is about the only thing that reassures you that you still exist or your readers still exist. So I felt pretty confident that people were waiting and people wanted this book. But in the end, hey, it's a business. And until the sales numbers came in last week, honestly, nobody knew if this story had a happy ending or not.
You're pretty much complete. You're pretty much have written the whole thing.
I have. I've written all three. I mean, I would say in these 5 years, I've written about 850,000 words, the equivalent of 8.5 standard thrillers, you know, what we all read, buy in the airport and read on the airplane.
Right.
Now, that said, having edited through the first to the degree that it was really ready for publication, and by that, in this case, I don't mean the prose. I tend to mean more. When a book is this complex, before you let it out in the world, there's a tremendous amount of vetting that has to go on in regards to the history, what's real, what's not, etc. So during that process, I made changes to the book. And so it will take me the 2 years that remain for these two to come out to bring volumes 2 and 3 to the level of Natchez Burning, even though they are certainly written.
Do you think it's some of your finest writing?
I would say this trilogy will end up being my finest work. Is it my finest writing? I won't necessarily say that. I'll make a confession. You know, as a commercial author, putting out a book every year or two, and my books, even my normal books, tended to be about twice as long as the conventional thriller writer's book.
Right.
I would say many of my books have been published essentially as first drafts, sometimes second drafts. It's very rare that I've had a chance to actually work and work until I have what I call lapidary prose, where every word's in its place. I write rhythmically, perhaps coming from being a musician, and a good day for me would be 20, 30 pages. I go a lot of the year without writing, then I write at a phenomenal rate, and I very rarely go back and change. Now, that's a long answer to your question, but I would say my best writing exists in books like The Quiet Game or Mortal Fear, which are further back, but there are certainly some passages in these three that I'm proud of, yes.
And ultimately, how are you feeling?
You know, this tour has been a real challenge. You know, normally after an accident, you spend a good deal of time rehabbing. But because I was already late with Natchez Burning at the time I had the accident, all I really had time to do was get out of the hospital, get fitted with a prosthetic leg. And in that time since, I've just been sitting in a chair. I have not done the rehab I needed to do. So This tour, which is a straight month with one or two cities every day, it's physically it's been a challenge. I'm making it so far. Last night I lost my voice, and today my event is with my bandmate Dave Barry in Miami, and I'm glad of that because I know I can rely on Dave to carry the event for me.
Wind him up and let him go.
There you go. That's right.
Well, the new novel is Natchez Burning. It is from William Morrow, and it is just a terrific, amazing novel. Greg Iles, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for spending time with us and for sharing this morning.
Thanks so much, Joe. I enjoyed it.
Greg Iles' latest is Natchez Burning. It is published by Morrow. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.